we'll just start off with a little report back on what happened last week. So this Friday, the 9th, we had a Free Mumia Abdul-Jamal rally at 14th and Broadway. They call it International Boulevard now. And this was a rally. The reason we call this rally is because Mumia, a former Black Panther who has been framed up by the police and in jail now close to 40 years, has a real opportunity to walk outside of those prison walls. Okay, so the rally, how many people do you estimate were at the rally?
At least 100.
Okay, so there was probably about 100 people at the rally. And coming up to the rally, yours truly, my name is Gerald. I had, I spoke at three forums, one at the bar there, the Starry Plow, first Saturday of every month. The Peace and Freedom Party has a forum at that bar. So we had the Starry Plow. I was then at Neville Proctor the next day, the Neville Proctor Marxist Library. And then the following day, Monday, I was at Global Exchange's offices through the kind sponsorship of San Francisco Occupy. Occupy San Francisco, that still, you know, exists. Things keep living. Our resilience is awesome. So we marched from 14th Street and Broadway, or International Boulevard and Broadway, Oscar Grant Plaza, we call it sometimes, down to the police station, and it was a spirited little march. By the time we took off, there were less people in the march, but important to know, it happened. We lived up to our promise. We had the Mumia march and demonstration, and then something that Eric and I were both at, the Sunday, last Sunday. If you notice, we played a past show last Sunday. We don't normally do that because we want people to tune into our program. We respect your time. But there was something called the Howard Zinn Book Fair at the Mission campus of the San Francisco Community College. In Battered Community College. And we were there. Eric, you were there advocating for the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, we got the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee here locally has just ratified its organizational structure and is looking for members and supporters and, you know, folks to pay attention to what we're up to and put in work. And so I got to go to the Howard Zinn Book Fair and advocate for that a little bit, collect some names, pass out some of our fancy new flyers, and go to a couple of the workshops there. Now, I got there a little late, but I saw a panel of three speakers talking about the rise of fascism and the alt-right and sort of three different perspectives on what can be done in response to those turning tides. And I saw a workshop on Ricardo Magón, the revolutionary Mexican anarchist. And I got to catch the tail end of a report back from an ISO member who has spent some time at Standing Rock, and this was on the day that the new Army Corps of Engineers decision was released, actually within an hour or so of the news breaking that the Army Corps of Engineers had halted the construction. This person, Regina, was giving a talk on her experience at Standing Rock, so the air was very electric and positive. And there was a nice little sort of upswell in energy. Every now and again, you kind of have to, you kind of have to pay attention to something good that comes out. Not all news is bad news. And I had an emotional moment when I heard that news. But to be clear, not that we have much to say about Standing Rock today, but to be very clear about the Army Corps of Engineers decision, it does not mean that the campaign at Standing Rock is over. It does not mean that the tribe has won definitively. It does not mean that the energy transfer partners will not build that pipeline. So recognize a victory when you see one, but recognize ongoing battles.
That's great. That's called a limited victory. We don't always cash in and actually slam dunk, but it was a victory because the response of the 1%, Mr. Obama, who represents the 1%, the Army Corps of Engineers, and all of that, that response was due to the resistance put up by the water protectors. Let's understand that. So if we understand that, if that's what happened, then we have to see that as a limited victory. I myself was engaged in building for the Mumia March. Basically, that's what I was doing all day. So I picked up a couple of books. And I missed the one forum that I did want to go to. There were no seats, standing room only. And I wasn't that enthusiastic. So it was a woman works with the group called the International Socialist Organization. And she wrote a book called From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. So I just peeped in there on that. But all in all, it was a wonderful day. People, bustling. And I talked to dozens and dozens of people about Mumia and the need to fight back.
All right. Yeah, all in all, a very positive day. Very positive day during a very sad weekend. So one piece of news before we, or we may have a couple pieces of news before we get into our main topic for today. I want to return briefly to the prisoner work strike that we haven't talked about in a while. The rerun that we played last week was our program from the heart of that strike, so hopefully memories have been refreshed a little bit. So something's happened last weekend to Kinetic Justice, one of the sort of central voices in the strike. In October, he was moved to the Kilby facility, which many of his comrades report is a facility for breaking the spirit and will of resistant prisoners, and subsequently was transferred to Limestone, which is a facility that specializes in solitary confinement and resistant prisoners. And here's an article on the most recent developments in Kinetic's case. Kinetic Justice of the Free Alabama Movement brutally attacked. And folks are being asked to call in and demand his relocation. So, last Friday, December 2nd, Free Alabama Movement's Robert Earl Council, that's Kinetic Justice, was brutally attacked while handcuffed by two officers, Dozier and Soldiers. Shoulders. That's officers Dozier and Soldiers at the Limestone Correctional Facility. He was assaulted while being escorted to the showers. He was pushed to the floor by one officer and was physically attacked while handcuffed on the floor. Afterwards, the second officer pulled the first officer off, sprayed Kinetic Justice with mace, and returned to his cell. It is not known as of this date if medical treatment was administered for his injuries. A use of force is excessive and violates the Eighth Amendment when it is not applied in an effort to maintain or restore discipline, but is used to maliciously and sadistically cause harm, where a prison official is responsible for unnecessary abuse and harm. Kinetic has expressed to us that he wants the wider movement to know that his life is in danger, and calls upon all of us to make some noise for him. We must demand that he be relocated due to his continued fear for his life, safety, and repeated harm inflicted by the guards. Here is a script for call-ins. So, as you have time throughout the week, please consider placing a few phone calls to the Limestone Correctional Facility. So here's a good script to use. I'm calling to demand that you release Robert Earl Council from solitary confinement and move him out of Limestone Correctional Facility immediately. He was brutally beaten on December 2nd and continues to fear for his life. You can write to Kinetic Justice, or you can send your complaint letters to the Limestone Correctional Facility at 28779 Nick Davis Road, Harvest, Alabama, 35749. You can call Warden Gordy at 256-233-4600. You can call the Alabama Department of Corrections at 334-353-3883. You can call the Office of Governor Robert Bentley, the Governor of Alabama, at 334-242-7100. And plenty of information on Kinetic can be found on the web. Ghost Town Prisoner Support has been writing to him and keeping updated on his case. You can find information, including his address, on our Facebook page. So, should we...
Now I was hoping we would get into... I want to share some information about Leonard Peltier, and I want to talk about him, but no. Right now, we want to start our inquiry and observations about this horrible fire that took place in Oakland. First, my brother Eric's going to talk about, you know, what happened when the thing first started, and I will follow through with what has been discovered since.
So, to be clear about what we're talking about, there was a rave at a warehouse in the Fruitvale District of Oakland on Friday, December the 2nd. A fire broke out at this location, and 36 people were killed, and unprecedented number of casualties. And it's worth, you know, before sort of diving into the politics that have inevitably surrounded this this incident in the days since, it's worth sparing a moment to think about these 36 people who were killed, some of whose names are not even released or known yet, and some of whom we know to be have been members of the queer artistic community in Oakland. They're folks that are very, very close for many people, and this is a tragedy that's hit really, really hard. So it's worth taking a moment to consider that. So, in the wake of this tragedy, it became clear, before the death toll was even known, it became very clear that that this was going to be a highly politicized event, and that people like Libby Schaff and her corporate handlers were going to seize this opportunity in some way or another to crack down on do-it-yourself spaces, on warehouse spaces, on underground events here in Oakland. And this, so I found an article actually as far away as the Santa Monica, this was in the Santa Monica Observer. There was a hit piece entitled "Political Correctness Caused the Oakland Ghost Ship Fire That Killed 36 Patrons." And it argues, this article, that LGBTQ safe spaces are, in as much as they are ideally safe from police infiltration, safe from the long and ever stronger arm of the law. The suggestion of this article is that this actually put a lot of people in danger. And so it's, there has been a move, and I looked all weekend for this tweet, and wasn't able to find it from an Oakland City Councilwoman that sort of, the content of the tweet suggests that, and what she says is that several conversations need to be had in the wake of the ghost ship fire, and she names anarchists and a so-called lifestyle of lawlessness as being causally implicated in the warehouse fire, as if people in our community desire to live in unsafe spaces for the sheer pleasure of flaunting the law, right? Do we all want to live in a space with one exit and bars on the windows just so we can give the middle finger to Libby Schaff, right? Is that why people are living in warehouses? It's a disgusting attitude.
Tell them why.
Why are people living in warehouses? People are living in warehouses because Oakland is the most rapidly gentrifying city,
yes,
in the United States.
Preach, come on.
Oakland is seeing evictions constantly. The wave that we saw begin in San Francisco is cresting here now. People are being consistently displaced, and now this fire has given Libby Schaff and her administration some leverage to put people in further danger of displacement.
Let me tell you about displacement, because I done been displaced more than once. 1975, I moved to the Bay Area from New York. I was staying in San Francisco on Guerrero. I was working out of the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Hiring Hall. That was the only place I could go with just my Social Security card and go to work. I started going there, and man, I learned a lot on the waterfront. But I was living in a railroad apartment with three other people, so it was four of us. Well, actually, it was five of us. $475 a month for the whole, for the rent for everybody. So everybody paid about $100, we got by. Now, I moved over to Oakland next year. Got my first apartment by myself with my family. $160 a month, right? The Stanford Apartments. Within 10 years, that same exact apartment, they were charging $1,600 a month for the exact same building, exact sane, and stupid-ass Americans think, well, that's my personal business. How much you pay for rent? You stupid motherfucker. You ain't the only one paying rent. That's a social and political question. It's not a personal question. So they got us so atomized, so broke down, we don't even understand how silly that is to think you're going to hide how much you're paying for rent. Silly bastards. But anyway, but they can't oppress us unless we're silly. Okay? But let me go on. Now, that same apartment is over $2,000. Same exact apartment. Now, to live in the city of Oakland for a single bedroom now, that shit done went up to $3,000. $3,000. Why do people want to live in Oakland? Because it's a hell of a town, baby. You're right there at the bridge. Where I lived before I had to move, 39th and Market, I was right there. I could go to San Francisco. I'd be in San Francisco in 15 minutes. Downtown Oakland, 5 minutes. Downtown Berkeley, 10 minutes. Why you want to live in Oakland? It should be obvious. But then not only logistically why you want to be in Oakland, but it's a hell of a town in another sense, and that is in the culture that has been created by the people who lived here. Oh, I guess 10 years ago, 46% of the people that live in Oakland were black people. Today, it's 22%. 22. Where did those people go? Those 20% of the, you know, where did they go? Well, they probably went to, you know, Antioch, Pittsburgh, Sacramento, Stockton, Modesto, in search of cheaper homes. Now, also, you know, I mean, this is insidious, man. It's been going on for a while. So you run all these people out, right? Who replaced them? Well, I'm sorry. I don't want to talk bad about techies because they're skilled workers. They're human beings. They're skill workers. That's right. We shouldn't be against people for what they do for a living. But Redwood City and what do you call them other cities up there?
Silicon Valley.
What is the cities? The cities.
Mountain View.
Palo Alto. Those son of a... All of those cities should have been held responsible to create housing for all of these people that came up here to work. They did not. Well, Palo Alto is one of the most expensive cities in America. More expensive than San Francisco, and San Francisco is more expensive than Oakland. So let's look at what's really going on here. I got a song for us I'm going to play after we finish this. It's called They Don't Give a Damn About Us, and you better know they don't. Because they you know, you have a leadership. They're supposed to plan how to accommodate people. You don't just... Oh, we want to take these techies in because they make more money. We can set up big fancy restaurants where we charge you $20 for a hamburger, you know. But what becomes of the people, man? People like me, I done got run out. I live over there on the edge of East Oakland now. Oh, I'm trying to hold on. I'm trying to hold on. So that's what Eric is talking about here. You see, that's what's behind all of this.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, the way that something like this, that a tragedy like this can have, you know, it's one thing before we even can, you know, properly, like, mourn our community members, we're also... have to keep one eye out for the fucking city inspectors that are gonna start coming through and coming through, and folks are, you know, we gotta mourn and we have to take space to do that, but we can't keep our head down all the way because we have to be looking out. We have to be looking out for the way that this tragedy has already rippled out into evictions, into inspections, into suddenly a wave of housing precarity that, you know, it existed before, and now it's fixing to explode. And so it's a time to look out for one another. It's a time to think about who we've lost, to check in with our friends and with our comrades, to make sure that they're okay, and to be ready to stand with the people who are going to come under threat as a result of this. So, Gerald will have some things to say about, you know, where the city's position is. I think before we do that, I'd like to report back on the vigil. The vigil that that took place on Monday evening for the folks who lost their lives as a result of the ghost ship fire. Now, at that vigil, thousands of people showed up to this. Thousands of people showed up to this this event on Monday.
Which one are you talking about?
I'm telling folks about the candlelight vigil on Monday evening
For the people that died.
For the people that died, yeah. Yes. So I got there about the time that that Libby Schaff was fixing to speak, and she did not even get to finish her speech. She was booed down because people know that what happened in this warehouse is not about anarchists, and it's not about this lifestyle lawlessness, and it's not about this victim-blaming bullshit that we saw come out of the city. That it's about the housing crisis. That it's about the displacement that she has facilitated. And so she was right
not
to feel
her alone.
Not alone.
The whole city council, all of those bastards.
No.
I'm sorry.
But I think she felt it that night. Oh, and man. I think she felt how angry people are. How rightly angry people are. And she said that in her speech. She said, you know, like, it's people are mad, and it's my job to absorb that. Well, she's going to be absorbing a lot more.
Let me throw this at you now. So, thank you very much, Eric, for that. But, in fact, it's much more sinister. Because here they go. People die. 35 people died.
36,
excuse me. And they're spitting on the dead. That's what they did.
Yeah.
That's what they did. They spit on these people because, you know, they were in this fire and it's your fault, blaming the victim. Let's look a little deeper. According to my main man, Darwin Bon Graham. Darwin is a journalist that works with East Bay Express. That's why you can't say, okay, everybody that's a reporter is no damn good. Because they're, you know, if they're all part of the head-fixing industry. Yeah, it's true. There is a head-fixing industry. Mostly, though, we're talking about who? We're talking about the mainstream media. New York Times, Wall Street Journal, the television networks, Channel 2, 4. You know, now, you have to be discriminating, though. You got to understand that every once in a while, there's a little rebel pops up here and there. Or there's a person that's working just for that paycheck, but is just trying to, you know, keep their little integrity. Well, and sometimes you find a decent reporter. And on the East Bay Express, there have been some decent reporters. Ollie Winston, for instance, on the police. You gotta read this stuff. And when you read a good article, remember who wrote it. The paper didn't write it. A person wrote it. So this guy, Darwin Bon Graham, did some research on this shit. And dig this. Here's what he found. He found that Oakland firefighters say their department is so badly managed that the ghost ship warehouse wasn't even in its inspection database. Now, do you know what that means? All right, let me explain. Let me explain, so because I want you guys to get this. I used to work as an electrician, and then I became a fire alarm, a fire safety so-called expert. And then, you know, my job was to check the equipment, to make sure people knew how to work the equipment. I can never forget fighting the goddamn principals so they would give me enough time to show the office secretaries how to use the goddamn equipment. What to do if the kids, because the kids used to pull the fire alarm a lot. Every time the kids pull the fire alarm, if you don't hurry up and call the fire department and tell them it's a false alarm, they mobilize, they come all out there to stop, because nobody wants children to burn. The firemen get right out there. Well, when they get out there and there's no fire, the Oakland Unified School District would be fine. One year, what I did was I took the check that was $20,000 in fines that we had to pay, and I took it to every school with me, and I said, I demand that you give me time to show these people how to use this equipment so that in the event of a false alarm, they know how to check, you know, and then hurry up and call the fire department. And I had an arrangement with the fire department that if it was a false alarm, we had a special number to call them and let them know. Now, you don't want to just routinely and in a knee-jerk fashion reject, you know, somebody says there's a fire. You don't say, oh, no, it's just the kids. No, you had to train people. So what does training mean? All it means is you explain. This ain't rocket science. A kid pulls the fire alarm. You go. We put in this fancy equipment where you could see exactly where that fire alarm had been pulled. So you go to that location, and you just use your common sense. Smell. Do you smell fire? Do you see anything? Do you see any smoke? Okay, there's nothing happening here. In some situations, the kids playing with matches set a fire in the hallway on the bulletin board. You know how the teachers have all their little play pretties on the bulletin board. Well, the teachers got on and put it out. Call the people. We got this. You don't play with the fire department. They save lives. And that's one thing, you know, I can say I did in that school district that was a good thing. And I changed a lot of light bulbs. Okay. But that thing, saving them lives, I like keeping the fire, you know, the fire department on its toes, and also the workers in the schools understanding how to deal with reality. So when they talk about their database, you're given your work. When I went out to repair the fire alarm stuff, I'm given a list. They're using a fancy word, inspection database. But in fact, all it is, it's a list of the places that you have to go. It's your work list of where you have to go to do your work. That's all. So when they say that the ghost ship warehouse wasn't even in its inspection database, that means that nobody had ever visited the building at all. Now, what's supposed to happen? What's supposed to happen is you're supposed to have enough inspectors to drive around town. That's right, aimlessly, drive around town. And you look, you say, wait a minute, there's people going in and out of there. I wonder what's going on. You get out of your damn car, and you go and you say, hey, what's happening, guys? Okay, so you say, all right, you got a building here. Do you mind if we inspect the building? Who is the owner, etc.? You go through the normal channels. They had never done this, ever.
So I'm kind of two minds about this, Gerald, and I want to hear what you think about this, because I think, like, to some of these folks, okay, the building was not up to code. The building was a fire hazard.
How do you know if it's not inspected?
Well, exactly. But to expect inspection itself from the city is a dangerous thing for some of these DIY spaces, right? Some of these spaces where folks are like have more folks living there than the landlord knows about. because that keeps things affordable for everybody.
I'm against that mentality 100%. Always, always, always get the inspection. Now, when you get the inspection, see, that feeds into what you said was not the case. You said people were not trying to spite them. No, they're not. They're trying to survive.
Yeah.
Yes, people are very leery of the government. You don't want to call a cop. Some bitch might shoot you. But that does that mean you never call the cops? Somebody steal my fucking car. What am I going to do? Call the anarchist? I call the cops. I call the cops trying to find out where my car is. So it's of course, I feel you. So let me just, let's not be bull, you know, let's not BS each other. I feel you. But you're 10 times better off with the inspection because at least that tells you what your tasks are. Inspection does not equal putting people out. You know, you can work with an inspector. You can say, okay, man, look, we live here. Can you show? Look, I got houses. I've worked in houses where they had to. All right, let's take my own house. I had a termite problem. I had to take out an entire wall of the house. The whole wall of the house was taken out. Naturally, that's not fun. But we still live there. We didn't move out of the house. We ain't going nowhere. So in that sense, there's no situation. You do have, it's true. All right, here's the problem. Okay, corruption. It is true that there are inspectors that are racist scum. That's right, I said that. And I meant that. Who would be so unprincipled as to use code violation matters to just clear a place out and move people out. So
and
that
landlords,
that is, right? Yes.
Landlords will do that too.
Okay. That's a justified. I'm not going to pretend that doesn't exist. It does. My experience has been different because I've seen it from all sides. So I've seen that negative side. I've lived life enough to see the negative. I've seen that. But that's not what it's really supposed to be about. And I've seen situations. For instance, I work. I do some volunteer work at the Omni. If you approach the inspector properly and make it clear, we want to make this place work, they don't come up with those. They know how to work with people. They know how to do it. Now, you start some shit, you might get some. Okay? So, I understand that. I'm not going to run away. I can't run away from that. That's the problem of living in a capitalist society. Okay?
Yeah.
You're right. But I would still argue you're better off if you know what's wrong with the place. And look, they didn't even have a stairway, bro. They had some, you call pallets. They stacked some pallets up, thought that was real creative to use as a stairway. Well, what was the consequence of that? Well, when the fire started, the pallets caught. There was no way to get out. They were trapped. So wouldn't it have been better if someone had planted into their little minds that, wait a minute, the framework of your stairway has to be made of metal or concrete? For that very reason. Code is not a punishment for people that don't have. Code represents the best practices of buildings. All right, as an electrician, I can just tell you the whole history of code because I studied it. And it's really true. That code, the reason you have codes is to protect human life. For instance, the capitalist system is messed up, so the bosses, electrical bosses, push through the acceptance of aluminum as wire. Why? Because aluminum's cheaper than copper, guy. It's real simple. What was the result of it? Houses blowing up, burning out, because aluminum is more malleable than copper. So when you use a big set screw on the aluminum backs up so much easier that it wound up creating a small area of airspace between the set screw and the aluminum. Over time, what happened? A small spark may start up whenever you turn the thing on. And then Well, as you all know, sparks turn into flames. So, because of the loss of life and property, they changed the code. You can't use aluminum that much anymore. The code itself is not the enemy. It's the 1%. You understand what I'm saying?
I know we're like maybe not prepared to answer this right now, but do you know of, or could we maybe I'll look into this here in a second, but of resources that people can, so something online or someplace that folks can go and, you know, read the codes, read the suggestions, here's how to do it yourself, you know, retrofit your space.
Okay, no, listen, just right now, I'm going to just tell you, that's totally feasible if you have the mind to do that. The code is a public thing. It's not a secret document of the Ku Klux Klan or something. The code is a public document. You go right online. You can read the code. And not only that, I have found that even among electricians, because I know we have our share of racists and bigots and idiots, but there's also decent people. And I have gone online and there's all kind of what they call do-it-yourself, DIY kind of stuff to show people and explaining why there's a code for that. And it's very useful on YouTube. So this is not some secret conspiracy locked with 7 different locks. And no, brothers and sisters and friends, the code exists to save life and property. And the only reason I personally am interested in the property is because your life is inside of it sometimes. But let's go on. So this wasn't even in the database, but they were condemning the people for what it really is, the people like Libby Schaaf, not just Libby Schaaf, but the people that run the Oakland Unified School District, they don't ring the alarm and say, you know what, actually we need the budget has been cut to the bone and we can't keep the buildings up. We can't take care of it. No, I got this guy, Antoine, whatever his name is, the guy that was the super... No, not the landlord. The landlord was a woman. But I'm talking about Oakland Unified School District. Guy's getting paid half a million dollars a year to be the so-called superintendent. He's leaving and going to Washington for what? More money. Okay? So that's how they think. As long I gotta get mine, I'm out to get it. I must get mine, I'm out to get it. And fuck everybody else. I'm sorry. I know it's Sunday and I'm hoping I didn't insult anyone by using that vile word, but it's a vile world. Vile world. So whistleblowers say that the fire chief, the mayor, and the city council fail to advocate for sufficient resources. Once again, the person who wrote this is Darwin Von Graham. To Oakland's fire inspectors, the Ghost Ship warehouse really was invisible. The extremely dangerous building sailed unseen for years, evading fire safety inspectors until it burned on Friday night. Last Saturday morning, as first responders began to enter its smoldering rubble in search of victims, several Oakland Fire Department employees looked up the warehouse fire code inspection history. But when they attempted to pull records for 1315 31st Avenue from their own Fire Prevention Bureau's files, they discovered nothing. Now you take a bite of that for a minute. They discovered nothing. So this is not, understand this, this is not my personal opinion. This is not my personal condemnation of capitalism although it is a condemnation of capitalism. But this is what happened, brothers and sisters. They discovered nothing. It's not even in the system, one firefighter said. He asked not to be identified for fear of retaliation from the city for speaking out. So not only do they not do their job, but if you tell the people that they're not doing it, they fire you. Snowden, WikiLeaks, Chelsea Manning, you get it? We should defend all whistleblowers. Since the tragedy, he and five other firefighters have explained to the Express how the department's building inspection program, which should be in the front line of fire prevention and safety, is dangerously understaffed and disorganized. So just know this. In fact, just 6 fire inspectors for the entire city of Oakland are left to investigate more than 4,200 commercial and residential properties every year. Stop and think about it. Let's go. Let's do the math. 6 divided into 42. That's 800 buildings a man. That means they would, if they were to actually even visit, they would have to visit 3 buildings a day. Damn near. Now, to really do a serious investigation, you can't just show up. Hey, I'm your friendly inspector. How you doing? What's up? I'll check you later. No, you have to go in the building. You have to go underneath the building. You have to see if there is there an attic. What are the walls made of? You got a checklist to talk about. Wait a minute. It looks like they added a circuit here. When they added this device, is it going to overload the electrical system? Those calculations. Because people do things, they don't mean to hurt themselves. You think people want to burn themselves alive in their sleep? Of course not. They just wanted to put a plug in. But they don't know. And you're right. You're right. You're so right, Eric. I'm sorry. I'm a little defensive because I've worked as an inspector and as an electrician. And I didn't mess over people. And I've seen inspectors that didn't. But they are bastards. So I know it's true that homeowners, I'm talking about people that own their own home, are hesitant to call in the inspector. Yeah. You know, because then they scared the bastard might say, oh, whole building's got to go. Well, wait a minute, why the whole building got to go? Because really, he's working to gentrify. So that does happen. I'm not going to never, ever deny reality. Learn how to face it. You got to learn how to face it. It's an ugly world. But I do want brothers and sisters to know that the code is your friend. So you can acquire, as Eric just said, this knowledge on your own. Now, look. Let me give you a little more on this because I want to get into some other matters. Let me see here. Tell us a little more about why you think people don't trust the state.
Well, how much time we got right now?
Oh, well,
brother.
Just give me 4 minutes.
So I think that if, you know, we, like I said before, we got to be watching out for each other. We got to be looking for folks that are facing eviction or are folks who are living in spaces that are not up to code or that are not, you know, zoned for residences or what have you. And you know, in for some spaces it is a danger to, you know, have a representative of the city come in and inspect your place and report back on the findings to the landlord or the owner. That can be a really scary process, a really really dangerous process, and that puts people at risk of displacement. So I think it's maybe not an option for everybody to have a city inspector come in, but for those who for whom that's less an option, I think, you know, we can all do these kinds of things on our own. We can all think about, okay, here, this is what, you know, let's think logistically about our space. Let's think architecturally. Let's think about, you know, where the exits are. I think for anybody who's living anywhere, especially with other people, it's a good time for a conversation about, you know, what are we going to do if a fire breaks out here? Yeah. What is our action plan? Do we need to build ourselves any kind of infrastructure that will get window. People out quicker? Yeah, window.
Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
Where I live, we had a room with no window. If there was a fire in that house, you can't even throw a chair through a window and get out. So we had to stop using that room, you know, because that is definitely unsafe. And to be honest with you, due to poverty, and there was four people living in that room, two children. Stop and think. So this is real. That's why capitalism has to go, comrades. I'm sorry, I said it. Let's not ever let that go. But let us continue to try to understand this tragedy and how all these fakers, Libby Schaff, City Council, the people that's running, you know, they stuck this black lady up to be the, yeah, they did. It's a black lady that's the chief of the fire department. Now, I'm not against black ladies, okay? But should we judge the chief, the fire chief, as we judge anybody else that's in charge of something? I think so. The fact that she's black don't give her no pass. She's responsible here to at least say, look, call a press conference or something, say, look, we got a problem here because I don't have enough inspectors to do all this work. There were 4 to 5 years there was no fire marshal in the city of Oakland. It just fucked me up. I couldn't believe it. I'm sorry about that, but I just could not. I used to work with the fire marshal. That's how I did my little program over there at Oakland Unified School District. You know, I worked with him. He's a very serious man. He taught me. I went to special trainings, and I got a sense of how, look, here's an example. I once saw a film in a training where they showed a picture of people who were all dead, piled up in front of a door. The door only could open one way. The door could only open by opening the door and coming in. They got to fighting each other and panicking, and they couldn't get out the door, and they all died of smoke inhalation. Oh, yeah. You need an exit plan, let me tell you. That's why in most large buildings you'll see, they say, if in case of a fire, one, don't get on the elevator. Oh, no, I'm getting on the elevator. Later for that, man. Well, go ahead, you fucking idiot. Because if you get on, what if the fire is in the shaft of the elevator? You'll cook. Or what if the fire blows up the electrical and then the elevator ceases to work and you get stuck in an elevator? You die of smoke inhalation. When they say don't go in the elevator, there's a reason. Because if you're running down the stairs, even if you run into the fire, you can turn direction and go upstairs and go down another stairway. You understand? So you do want to think about how to survive, how to live. You don't want to be a silly jackanap running around. It's all good. No, it ain't all good. You got to figure out how to survive. Stay alive. So, I don't know, I was really hit by this because the about face Oakland has less than half as many fire inspectors, dig this, as cities with similar populations. What is that a reflection of? I'll tell you what, my brothers and sisters, fellow citizens, That is a reflection of the fact that we have a very ugly, corrupt government and a legacy of that in Oakland, where stuff has been messed up not just yesterday, but for a long time. They want to get more cops. Well, let's think of a lot of things we need more of besides cops. All right, so let's see what else we got here. I'm thinking. Okay, so one of the things they do here in Oakland a lot, I know people don't, we do it to our schools and our children pay for it. We have, like, when they started attacking the schools and trying to privatize them, one of the first things they had to do was get rid of the experienced teachers. Why? Well, one, they knew better. So right away, they're going to resist. But also, experienced teachers have went to school, gotten a master's degree. Some of them had PhDs and were teaching in a classroom. That's okay. Well, their salary was higher. They were getting maybe, you know, $50,000, $60,000 a year, whereas an entry-level teacher might get $30,000 a year. Well, if you look at the school like a factory or like a warehouse or something, then you want what? You want the young, inexperienced, and cheap workers so that you can overwork them, underpay them, and you save money and more money for you. But it's a school. It's our lives. The school is at the center of our lives, whether we want to admit it or not. And when it's not at the center of your life, it's because you ain't got no damn life. That school is a part of your community. And we don't want to chase off the most experienced and intelligent and well-trained teachers. Well, who benefited from that? They hired them in places like Walnut Creek. They hired them in other cities. It used to be 40% of the schools were black teachers. And these black teachers took their whole experience very seriously. Well, same thing can be said for people that work for the city in other capacities. If you want to keep the wages down and overwork people, you get the young and the inexperienced. And that's who we got in the fire department now. And I'm sorry, I'm not putting them down as human beings, but that's just a fact. That's a fact. City leaders have failed to advocate for more fire resources. We talked about that. I think we all know it's true. And now we have to search for answers. The Firefighters Union isn't the only organization to register complaints against the chief of the fire department. Last December, a group of Oakland Hills residents sent a scathing letter of no confidence to Libby Schaff, to the fire chief, and to other officials regarding the Oakland Fire Department's inspections program. All right? That's last December. The North Hills Community Association, which is located in the brushy and eucalyptus-crested terrain spanning Berkeley and Oakland, wrote that, and I'm going to quote this, "The Fire Prevention Bureau seems to have borne the brunt of budget cuts. The workload of existing staff has risen to impossible levels," unquote. They noted many inspections were performed by regular firefighters who lacked the proper training. They also said that the Oakland Fire Department doesn't maintain a list of qualified candidates for the inspector jobs. So when an inspector leaves, the city has to go through a lengthy process to find a replacement. You see, I mean, that's just basic stuff. Yeah. Basic. And I quote, oh no, all right. "Oakland is at risk of losing its institutional memory and experience," they warned. You see, I am certainly looking, my future is not a future of capitalism, because there is no future for capitalism. They're either going to burn the goddamn system, burn the earth, and we'll have global warming to the point where, you know, who knows what it would look like, what it would unfold like. and or there's a possibility of nuclear catastrophe. I don't want to see a capitalist future. But we do have to survive pending that revolution. And that's not an excuse to give up on the big change that we need. But we do want to have some institutional memory of people who have done this for years. We want to honor these elders who have been around, the ones that are not corrupted. Because believe me, there's people that's not corrupted that haven't sold out. And we learn from them. And they should teach the young so that they can be better informed. Okay, although they were forced on their homes, set in tinderbox in the hills, they were critiquing the same department and bureau tasked with making sure their homes, workplaces, and entertainment venues of Oakland's flatlands are safe. So these were people in the hills. And of course, we always talk about people in the hills, dude. They got money and da da da. But they don't care about none of us. Better hurry up and realize that. They laid blame on Reed's doorstep, too. Unger forwarded the letter to the head of Oakland's Employee Relations Department in March of this year. He felt it was a warning that the city needed to heed. Should some calamity occur, I imagine that some level of liability, moral, political, and possibly legal, would be attached to the entire bureaucratic structure that knew of these deficits for years and took no action to correct them. After the ghost ship tragedy, the calamity is now a reality. Only time will tell whether any of the problems afflicting Oakland's fire department, and especially its prevention bureau, played a role in leading up to ghost ship. We already know the answer to that, brothers and sisters.
So I did some quick typing along on my phone. I found an interesting little source for do-it-yourself at-home fire safety and prevention. It's a site called This Old House. And if you go to thisoldhouse.com/ideas/fire safety and prevention checklist. And I was going to ask maybe right before we move on if you... Since you've done this kind of work before, if you have any like one or two, like here's the main tip about like checking your home or your space or your event for fire safety.
Look, I've done several inspections and I've also worked on crews that were making a house safe. Garbage. Don't pile up useless garbage. Decide what you're going to do with stuff and get rid of it. Don't pile up garbage under your house, for instance. Particularly flammable objects. You don't want to save wood under the house. If you're going to keep that wood because you think you want to build something with it, make a rack outside of the house. You know, it's okay to keep metal, for instance, underneath your house, but not wood, not newspapers. Okay, it's little things like that. Think about your future. Think about your children. And you too can come up with intelligent, you know, maneuvers that you can do.
All right, folks, we're back here to talk a little bit about Leonard Peltier. So Leonard Peltier, for those of you who don't know, is, next to Mumia, one of the most, popular and well-known political prisoners in the United States. Leonard Peltier was an active part of the founding in the early years of the American Indian Movement, which is an indigenous rights organization that formed out of Minneapolis. In 1968, to facilitate and engage in indigenous and ecological resistance, the American Indian Movement as it exists today has been very active in Standing Rock with the Sioux out there who are fighting the pipeline. So what happened with Leonard Peltier? So in 1977, he was convicted and sentenced to 2 consecutive terms of life imprisonment. He is alleged to have committed first-degree murder in the shooting of 2 FBI agents during a 1975 conflict on the Pine Ridge Reservation. So this is just, again, similarly to the Mumia case, this is well recognized as a frame-up, right? And it's the same sort of frame-up Senti talked about, Red Fawn Fallis, 2 weeks ago, right? The woman who's facing felony charges for having supposedly shot at the police in Standing Rock while she was being arrested with her face on the ground is supposed to have shot at police. She is... folks sort of recognize her case as a replication of this structure that happens over and over again. These pigs framing up activists and folks who are standing up for themselves. And that's the story of Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier has been in prison now for nearly 40 years. And as he is one of the most well-known political prisoners, as indigenous rights and indigenous sovereignty gains some traction in terms of the national political conversation, whatever that is, folks are asking President Obama to, with his final few days in office, it's traditional for a president to give some symbolic pardons as a way of making a political statement, and Obama is being asked to pardon Leonard Peltier. Gonna go to another song.
I was arrested in Western Canada on February 6, 1976, the date from which my sentence officially begins. I'd been living with some Indian friends in Alberta's Rocky Mountains. For most of that year, I was jailed in Vancouver, fighting extradition to the U.S., that the FBI was determined to do anything, however illegal, to get me back after Butler's and Robidoux's acquittal in Cedar Rapids, and it did. Affidavits from a woman named Myrtle Pourbaix were presented at the Canadian courts, claiming she was an eyewitness to the agent's deaths and also an ex-girlfriend of mine. She also said I was the father of her children. Now you can imagine how shocked and sickened I felt that day at the extradition hearing when that poor woman's words were read in court. I hadn't the slightest idea who she was, having never met or even heard of her in my life. She, like me, like every one of us, was a pawn in their illegal, their malicious game. Several years ago, evidence was uncovered that flatly proved the government had suborned this witness and coerced her false testimony. Her affidavits were later exposed for the lies they were, but not before they did end my attempts to avoid extradition from Canada. Some very curious things went on after my arrival in the States. Without explanation, my trial, which began in March 1977, was shifted from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where it was to have been held before the same judge who had presided over Butler's and Rubidoux's acquittal. It was switched to an openly hostile court in Fargo, North Dakota, presided over by a judge renowned for his hard line on Indians. The evidence of government misconduct and willful illegality that had so swayed the Cedar Rapids jury wasn't even allowed in the Fargo trial. Nor was the whole history of government-initiated turmoil at Pine Ridge in recent years. What's more, I was amazingly prohibited by the judge from pleading self-defense, as Butler and Robidoux had done on the same charges. My entire conviction was based on circumstantial evidence, most of it entirely fabricated, including the so-called murder weapon that was never mine and that had nothing to do with the events at Oglala, as the FBI well knew. And a farce of unbridled lies and flagrant coercion of witnesses played out there in that courtroom before that incredibly hostile judge and that utterly disinformed and intimidated jury. And meanwhile, to be absolutely certain the jury was intimidated, The government concocted a cock and bull story, quickly spread as gospel by the press, that AIM was going to assault the courtroom at any instant. They went so far as to paint the courtroom windows black. Armed marshals lurked everywhere, armed to the teeth, eyeing every shadow for non-existent AIM guerrillas. The jury was moved around under heavy guard by SWAT teams. The windows of their bus were taped over. The whole thing was a fabrication, like so much else. And meanwhile, the prosecution tossed out endless lies and phony evidence and suborned witnesses, and the judge, of course, allowed all that. The understandably terrified all-white jury, eager to get out of there as quickly as possible, took barely 6 hours to come to a guilty verdict on 2 counts of first-degree murder. Towards the end of the trial, the prosecutor pointed at me, and he told the trembling jury in a thundering voice, This man seated here before you, meaning me, Leonard Peltier, and no other, this man had cold-bloodedly killed those already injured agents at point-blank range with a high-powered rifle. And yet many years later, at one of my appeals hearings, this very same prosecutor admitted in court that the government had no idea at all who killed those agents. He stated for the record, and these are his exact words, we did not have any direct evidence that one individual, as opposed to another, pulled the trigger. Well, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals at my 1986 hearing for a new trial acknowledged that there had been fabrication of evidence, withholding of exculpatory evidence, coercion of witnesses, as well as improper conduct by the FBI, why then wasn't I instantly released from prison as an innocent man, which I was, and had been proven to be even by their own numerous admissions? Simply because of, as I've always stated, any Indian would do to pay for the deaths of their agents, preferably an Aimster from outside who could be accused of stirring up trouble on the res. Turns out, I was to be their boy. Yep, me, Leonard Peltier. I was the last Indian left to railroad for the deaths of their two agents. If they couldn't get the real killer, they damn sure were gonna get me. And they did. The judge who heard that prosecutor's admission still denied my appeal, ruling that even though not one shred of credible evidence remained to prove my guilt, I had still been guilty of quote-unquote, aiding and abetting in the deaths of the two agents simply by being at the Jumping Bulls that day, and that I would therefore continue to remain behind bars for those 2 consecutive lifetime terms. This even though the Fargo jury had given me those maximum sentences specifically for supposedly going up and personally murdering those agents at close range with a high-powered weapon, not for the vague crime of aiding and abetting. And then a few years later, that very judge who had denied my appeal, no doubt under tremendous pressure from elements within the government, declared that the government had been at least equally responsible for the deaths of its own agents. And he actually wrote a letter to the president urging him to commute my sentence. The fact that no real evidence at all was enough to convict me, and that no amount of genuine evidence to the contrary, no, however overwhelming, seems to be enough to win my release or even a retrial, much less parole, after nearly a quarter of a century, is why I am often called, no doubt to the great embarrassment of the United States government, a political prisoner.
Okay, so glad to have Leonard Peltier explaining his case on the air. Very good. We have another case going on right here in Oakland, and that is the case of Omar Shakir. Omar Shakir was arrested July 25th in an early morning militarized raid. These police were dressed up in military uniforms, might have been Homeland Security. We don't even know who it was because they didn't. One, they won't say who they are. And two, you know, we honestly don't know what they do to us in this madness called the war on terrorism. For people who have listened to our program before, you may be aware that on the 21st, I'm sorry, on the 24th of July, Nadia Clark, Oakland Police Department sergeant, was in a high-speed chase and had an accident, had an auto accident. After that auto accident occurred, someone fired a weapon at her. The police went bonkers, tried to seal off a 10-block radius in vain. But then through their flawed intelligence, they wound up raiding the home of Omar Shakur. They attacked the home. They put the bombs in the front and the back of the home. Snipers on the roof, tore down the fence. All of this madness. And it was the wrong house. And we know it's the wrong house because they actually arrested the person that fired the weapon, which I want to emphasize, did not hit, the bullet did not hit the policewoman in this case. But that person was arrested in Stockton the following Thursday. We have been to court now more than six times, and they have failed to drop the charges against Omar Shakur. They have failed to drop the charges against Omar Shakur, who they know for a fact, they know he's innocent. It's not maybe. They know he's innocent. So here's a situation where we need your support. The family is asking for court support for solidarity. We're asking all those who hear my voice right now, if you can, to come to court to this Tuesday, the 13th. The court dates, it says it's 8:30 at 1224 Fallon. You don't have to, if you can't be there at 8:30, just come. They didn't even start talking about what was happening until it was already 10 o'clock. So if you can't make 8:30, still come. They say it's going to be in Department 11. They lie. It's supposed to be in Department 11, but they always shift the room to another court house. I will be posted up at Department 11 to catch people. But what you want is the case of Omar Shakur. Demand that they drop the charges for brother Omar Shakur. His court date again, which we need you to come out and show solidarity, is Tuesday, the 13th of December, Department 11 at the Fallon Street, Oakland Courthouse. Thank you very much for your attention on that very important matter. I'll be right with you.
All right. So, hope to see everyone out at Omar's next court support date. Court support is incredibly important as we move into the next presidency, as you know, protests begin to develop and grow, as we approach, you know, January 20th and the inauguration and all of the actions that will take place on that day and hopefully beyond that day. It's important to support each other when our friends, when our comrades and our neighbors get wrapped up. It's important to turn up, to show these DAs that they have friends.
That's right. Keep talking for a minute.
All right. To show, to put political pressure where it needs to be. All right, here's...
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
walking the streets, getting stopped for being out. Ask where you're headed, told not to open your mouth. Picture in all the papers, story on every TV. Totally defenseless, all hopes put on a PD. Cries of not guilty do you no good, for the message has been heard. Black, stay out of our neighborhood.
Pastoral scenes of the gallant self, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh, and the sudden smell of burning flesh.
Now it's Space Strikes New Out. That's what it's all about. Back in the days, black in the days, you're always out. You never end. I think it's for yourself you should bend. Somebody's always getting hung just for the song that they sung. You can never be right, just if you're a little black like night. White flies and small flies, why are they so simple and slight? Because nothing's quite so simple when you're black like night.
Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, and for the tree to dry. Here is the strange and bitter cry.
May 25th, 1911. I feel the wind beneath my feet. I feel my heart and mind racing. Why do you picnic me? This madness, this insanity. Tie a piece of hemp around my throat and let me swing back and forth. May 25th, 2001. I feel my mind breaking down. I'm trapped in a world God didn't make.
This whole program is dedicated to the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King. You know that, anyway. Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow men. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his Bible at his side, from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think that this great man is dead. Oh yeah. Well, the murders never cease. Are they men or are they beasts? What do they ever hope to gain? Will my country too late for us all? And did Martin Luther King just die in vain? Cause he'd seen the mountaintop. And he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think, cause we're headed for the brink. He was for equality for all people, you and me, full of love and goodwill. Hate was not his way.
That's the late, great Nina Simone. The late, great, magnificent Nina Simone. Right now, we're going to get into the late, great Fidel Castro. And we want you to think about this a little bit. Because me and Eric talked about this. We're not trying to get off into a heavy ideological deal right now. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to, to get people to stimulate you to think for yourself. Because they've had this ugly and stupid campaign where they think they can control the way we think. And actually, it's not been very successful. Let me give you an example. They've been going on the news. They show on the news, on their idiot box. They show you people laughing and dancing because Castro's dead. Well, those people that are laughing and dancing are dyed in the wool counter-revolutionaries, for the most part. We call them gusanos, worms, that have left Cuba because they were against the revolution. That's basically it. Well, now people say, well, didn't Castro put these counter-revolutionaries in jail and break up families? Well, look, number one, before you can be asked to have an opinion about any matter, you should do a little bit of independent study. Look at things and learn to make up your own mind. This little section of our program here, Slave Revolt, is designed specifically for that, to plant some seeds, to get you to think for yourself, not to preach to you about what you ought to think and feel. Look at it that way, okay? Now, here we go. I want to first a basic outline about the legacy of Mr. Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution. So look, Cuba, right, is the only country in the Americas without child malnourishment. We have child malnourishment in the United States, the richest country in the world. We have child malnourishment. They don't in Cuba. Think about that. Now, they don't have billionaires either, but they don't have child malnourishment. Number two, Cuba has been declared an international paradise for infants by UNICEF. So UNICEF is a UN, United Nations body, that looks after small children. Number three, Cuba has the lowest child death rate in the Americas. That includes the United States, by the way. The Americas. Okay, here we go. Number four, 130,000 medical school graduates have graduated from medical school in Cuba since 1961. Stop and think about that. This is a country of, 10 million people maybe? Number five, Cuba has a student to teacher ratio of 10 to 1. I'll take your ass to, right now, I'll take you right here to the flatlands in Oakland and you look. And I'm not putting the teachers down because they're struggling to do the best they can. 35. In bad situations, sometimes we have 40 kids in a classroom. But certainly, 10 to 1 is a favorable environment for children to learn. Number 6. Cuba has eliminated homelessness. There is no homeless people in Cuba. Number 7. Cuba developed 4 vaccines against cancer. More on that later. That's the other little contribution I'm going to make. Number 8. 54% of the national budget in Cuba is used for social services. Number 9. Cuba sent 796 doctors and nurses to Liberia and Guinea just recently to fight the E. coli, crisis. Number 10, Cuba has the best educational system in Latin America, hands down. Number 11. Cuba has one of the best human development indexes. Number 12. Cuba is the first country to eliminate mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And finally, all of this accomplished under an embargo by the most powerful country in the world. Hello? I do want to mention also a major contribution that Mr. Castro consciously decided to do to help Africa is that when the civil war broke out in Angola and there was a three-way civil war, South Africa came in on the side of UNITA and invaded Angola. When South Africa, the United States, the CIA invaded Angola, Castro came in on the side of the MPLA and the Angolan people. And they defeated the South Africans, the United States, the CIA, and unfortunately China was allied with them temporarily, but defeated them and ran them racist South Africans back into their country. And the major battle was called the Battle of Cuito Canaveral. Little Cuba defeated South Africa and the United States. Never forget that. And that was the beginning of the end for apartheid. Now, this article is taken from The Atlantic. Cuba's innovative cancer vaccine is finally coming to the United States, finally coming to America. The country has a whole arsenal of unique drugs locked behind the U.S. embargo. Last week, in a historic first, a box of water made it from Havana to Buffalo, New York. It was a roundabout journey since you can't just FedEx a box from Cuba to the United States. The embargo, no commercial cargo flights, etc. The box flew first to Toronto. Customs brokers then escorted it across the U.S.-Canada border to its final destination at Roswell Park Cancer Institute. Why such a production for a box of water? It was the test run for a promising lung cancer vaccine called CIMAVAX, which was developed in Cuba and soon will begin clinical trials in the United States. But no one in America has ever run a clinical trial with Cuban drugs. And no one was even sure logistically how to ship fragile cargo between the two countries. Again, the embargo, no commercial cargo flights, etc. So the researchers devised a roundabout route and tested it with this box of water. Quote, "We actually wanted them to ship a box of beer," joked Kevin Lee, an immunologist at Roswell who is leading the trials. "But it turned out to be too complicated," he said. This shipment came, of course, at a time of thawing relations between U.S. and Cuba. The embargo is still in place. Only Congress can vote to lift it. But the Obama administration has been issuing executive actions easing restrictions on trade. Wait a minute, hold on. And made it easy to carry out U.S.-Cuban medical research. And the Food and Drug Administration promptly followed by approving clinical trials for the Cuban lung cancer vaccine at Roswell. Okay, the CIMA vax is so interesting, scientifically speaking, because it belongs to a new class of cancer treatments called immunotherapy. Okay, that's a fancy word. Immunotherapy. Rather than using a scalpel or radiation or chemicals to take cancerous cells out directly, immunotherapy stimulates the patient's own immune system to fight cancer. A few immunotherapies are already on the market, and pharmaceutical companies are racing to develop the next. For the past two decades, Cuba, a country with a tiny biomedical research budget, has been quietly sitting on CIMA vax. And this vaccine could be just the first of several Cuban drugs currently locked behind the embargo to make the U.S. So, I don't want to hear no criticism of my man. No, that's not true. There's much to criticize because, in fact, he's human, as you are. So besides that, we know ain't nobody perfect. But more importantly, there are criticisms. You know? For instance, the questions of, I oppose capitalist democracy as a sham. But that doesn't mean I'm against all democracy. I'm for workers' democracy, proletarian democracy. I think we ought to be able to vote in our unions, for instance. I think in a society like Cuba, there should be workers' democracy. So I am critical of that. But overall, Mr. Castro is quite a fella.
All right. So rest in peace to Fidel. So I've got, all right, so we've got one last song to wrap up on, and it's one that if you listen to Berkeley Liberation Radio, that you may have heard, it's a song by Them Are Us Too, or Tout, is Cash Askew's music project. Cash is one of our community who was lost in the fire last Friday. So, wanted to play this song of a project that he and his partner would work on. Her and her partner would work on. Here we go. So, rest in peace to all who were lost in the fire last week. Keep them in your thoughts. Keep their families in your thoughts as well. Have a great week.